Join us as we cover many an insane movie and numerous cult TV phenomenons. Are you ready to get jacked up? Are you with us? Then listen on.
My name is Steve, and I am the co-host of Cinema Decon, a movie review podcast that revisits the movies of the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. And more relevant to the topic at hand, I am also the host of Music Rewind, a podcast where guests come on to tell their stories about their favorite musical albums. A big thank you to the Jacked Up Review Show for inviting me on to talk about one of the most legendary bands in all of classic rock, the Eagles. Originally, I was going to be on the show live, but a scheduling conflict with the mouse in Florida got in the way. So thank you guys for allowing me this chance to ramble about one of my favorite bands. Now, we have all heard of the Eagles. They're everywhere. Hotel California, Lion Eyes, Desperado, Take It Easy, the list goes on. A staple of rock stations since Don Henley, Glenn Frey, Bernie Leadon, and Randy Meisner released their first album in 1972. I'm sure the full show will touch on their beginnings with Linda Ronstadt, songwriting with Jackson Browne and J.D. Souther, the band Turmoil, and all the rest of the Eagles saga. But what I'd like to mention is how I discovered this amazing band. All credit goes to my father, my older cousin, and WLRZ, Classic Rock Radio of the Illinois Valley, back in the 80s. WLRZ seemed to play Desperado every hour on the hour. It was beaten into our brains. Amazing song, but a tad overplayed. There's so much more in the Eagles catalog. Then one day in probably 88 or 89 at my uncle's house, I was about to commit the great sin of placing a needle down on track 5 of the Eagles' greatest hits to hear Desperado again when my cousin Alan stopped me. He imparted the great advice to listen to the whole album. So we did, and my young mind was blown. The songs were fantastic, every single one. I needed more. So I went to my own classic rock guru, my dad. Dad, I need more Eagles. What do you got? Luckily, he had the double cassette of Eagles Live. Now, you talk about a fantastic tape. It had everything. Take It Easy, New Kid in Town, Saturday Night, Hotel California, and plenty of others. Not to mention the criminally underplayed Severn Bridges Road. Now, that is a song that needs to be played every hour on the hour. On the radio. It's amazing. The harmonies in that tune, please check it out. It's wonderful. During the summer, you could find me mowing lawns with Eagles Live, playing in my Walkman, and with me doing my best to improve on the Eagles' trademark five-part harmony by making it a six-part. Unfortunately, with the lawnmower going, no one will ever know how great that could have been. As time crept into the 90s, grunge took over, and my friends all had those CDs where I'm buying Hotel California and One of These Nights, perfectly content living a band that was no longer relevant in the day and age, and let alone together, as they all hated each other. But then something magical happened in 1994. Hell freezes over. The Eagles reunited. This was a monumental point in my life. I was counting the days. I told all of my friends about it. No one cared. It didn't matter. The Eagles were reuniting for a live special on MTV in April of 94. This was for me. I was 14 years old, and I thought that this was just being put together for me. When the day finally came, this long Spanish guitar intro morphed into Hotel California, and that was all the high school angst I needed. It was just wonderful. I still listen to the album today. Although I no longer own a VCR, I do still have the originally taped VHS, commercials and all. Over time, now that I have actual adult money in my pocket, I've been able to collect all of their albums and discover deep cuts one after another. Duel and Dalton, Train Leaves Here This Morning, Certain Kind of Fool, Try and Love Again, Old 55. There's just so many songs that you probably haven't heard. I've had the privilege of seeing them in concert twice. Once in 2002, my dad and I went for their first farewell tour. Then recently in 2020, right before the world ended, I saw them perform Hotel California in its entirety with my dad and my brothers. We mourn the loss of founding member Glenn Frey, who passed away in 2016, and his presence was missed on stage. However, I will give credit to Vince Gill and Deacon Frey, Glenn's son, for doing a decent job trying to fill those big shoes.
And welcome back. Here we are doing another deep dive into music history. We got every Eagles song founder, Peter Hansen. How are you?
Doing fine. Thanks for having me.
All righty. So just doing it, just a casual just chronicle of how we got into the Eagles. So you're older than me, so I take it you know, you had good parents who showed you the ropes of digging into all those various albums.
I wish I could say that they were the gateway. I don't know that they necessarily were. So where I fall generationally is I'm just a little kid becoming conscious of music at the time Hotel California comes out. So the three singles that are released from Hotel California, which are the title track, Life in the Fast Lane, and New Kid in Town, really form some of my earliest musical memories. And they're tied in with growing up in Michigan. So they're very much embedded in my childhood in the same way that a lot of the band's music is embedded to adolescence for people a little bit older than me, or young adulthood for people a little bit older than them. And that's true of a lot of these iconic bands, is you imprint very strongly, based on when you first hear them. I'm sure there are whole swaths of fans who enter the Eagles story in the period between 1980 and 1994 when they're not a recording entity. And I'm sure there are younger fans who only know the Eagles as what you would call in the industry a heritage band, where their primary recording period is behind them. But for me, it was very much tied in with childhood. And then my progression from there is they were very prominent in my consciousness as I entered the years where I started buying my own albums. And by the time I was really focusing on who the artists were, Henley had already started recording his solo stuff. So more likely than not, the first Eagles-related album that I owned of my own was actually his second solo LP, Building the Perfect Beast, the one with Boys of Summer. So my adult experience of the band is very Henley-centric. I was very focused on his solo career. I saw him solo live before I saw the band live. And I kind of backfilled the story of the band based on my interest in him. And by the time the band reunited, I had become a pretty hardcore fan and I knew the catalog quite well. So I was lucky enough to see them in 94, the first year they were back together. And since then, they've been enough of a part of my life that by the time this 50th anniversary of the band's first release came around this year, I felt motivated to go ahead and do this blog, Every Eagle Song, in which, as the title would suggest, I offer reviews and comments and interpretations of every tune they recorded. But then I also have some infrastructure added to the blog in terms of discographies. And it really is just a repository for this lifetime of data and opinion that I've gathered while listening to and enjoying this band. So yourself, how did you jump on the train?
Just constant radio play. I was familiar with all the big ones of the 70s and 80s. Van Halen, Def Leppard, what's the other one? You know, just Led Zeppelin, obviously. But just, Eagles were just in there, you know, just really appreciating Don Henley and Glenn Frey and even their solo careers. And, you know, I saw how everyone could even be critical of how Joe Walsh was with his solo career, but I was just one of those where it's like, I just took it in. I dug the ensemble, how some considered them soft rock. Others were like, no, they're country rock, but they're more mainstream. And they're just sampling in all these kinds of different genres and just blending it together. But I just, it's just a great melody from their vocals and just very just engaging guitar skills. And like you, I would just casually just see them, you know, in a casual Rolling Stone interview or just music documentary that was playing on PBS or what have you. And I was like, you know, there's a reason these guys are legends. They had it rough, and then they sang about their unusual upbringing. And then, you know, from that point on, just one hit after the other. And I can't ever say that any album exactly sounded all the same. And even when some of their newer stuff didn't necessarily take off, I just still just dug how they had this just undying energy feel to them.
It's a really interesting progression artistically, because right from the beginning, even though they are rooted in country rock, which actually you can attribute primarily to one of the founding members, Bernie Ledden, who had been a peripheral associate with the Byrds by being a member of the Flying Burrito Brothers, who was also in a group called Dillard and Clark. Henley always cites as one of the founding artists of the country rock aesthetic. So by the time the four original members, which is Ledden and Meisner, Randy Meisner plus Henley and Fry, by the time they come together, there has already been this foundation built for country rock by a number of other artists, notably the Burrito Brothers. And interestingly, when the band emerges, one of the principles of the band is it's going to be four lead singers, which is a fairly unusual model.
Yeah.
If you think of the Beatles ostensibly had four lead singers by the end, but Ringo was really sort of a guest vocalist because he didn't write a lot of material. And as we were just reminded watching that Get Back documentary, George was kind of grasping for space in the band underneath the Lennon-McCartney power vacuum. And of course we can, the Lennon-McCartney power structure, I should say. And we can see a parallel to that with the Fry-Henley power structure. But over the course of just those six albums in the 70s, and the main body of work is actually pretty small, because even the Beatles in a shorter run produce more albums. But over the course of those six albums, there's a very clear evolution from gentle, rootsy, kind of loose country rock, moving into slightly more guitar-driven area. At the same time, they carve out this soft rock pocket. So an album that occurs in the middle of the run, an album called On the Border, produces their first number one, which is Best of My Love, which was an adult contemporary hit and feels to some musically almost as soft as something like the Carpenters. And yet on that same record, they bring in their fifth member, which is Don Felder, who's this really fiery guitar player who can shred. So you hear him all over Already Gone, which is a full octane pedal to the metal rock number. So the thing that they're doing as they progress throughout the 70s is balancing these two identities, really three if you involve country rock. So there is their country rock roots where they started. There's the ballad space, the adult contemporary soft rock space where they found a lot of success. And then there's this rock place that they really wanted to explore. And of course, the real big transition happens is when Joe Walsh folds in for Hotel California, which is really the moment at which they coalesce as an artistic unit. It's the apex of their songwriting. It's the apex of their performing. And not coincidentally, you have Joe showing up with those slide figures that just cut like an arc welder. And the way he plays off Felder, most famously in the dual guitar outro of Hotel California. It's kind of unimaginable if you're listening to the first album, that ensemble, that rootsy four vocalist ensemble singing soft country rock, kind of unimaginable that they will produce this heavy guitar anthem that goes toe-to-toe with Stairway every time a classic rock station does the countdown to the best rock songs ever. But that's what's interesting about watching any band evolve. Can they grow past their original form and still retain something of their identity? So even on that that album Hotel California, the closing song, Last Resort, which is this Don Henley environmentalist epic, it's laced with pedal steel, and nothing could be more country than pedal steel. And that, I think, is what makes them such a uniquely American band and such an interesting band for the audience to embrace, is because, as you were getting at, they encompass so many colors from the palette of American music. You can hear a little bit of Motown, you can hear a little bit of Memphis soul, you can hear pure country, you can hear a lot of the Detroit rock and roll from Glenn's upbringing, and so on. And to me, I think that's what's endlessly interesting about them, is although it all falls under the header of the Eagles, because it's the same group of people, notwithstanding membership changes, making music, the identity of the band almost changes pretty substantially with every single album.
1,000%. Because, I mean, you have so many other solo artists like Prince or David Bowie who would try out something different each decade, each album. And yeah, the Eagles were just always on that in general. Like, that was their identity, just their unpredictability. And I you know, you're not the first one to tell me, you know, they pretty much are kind of the American Beatles, where it's just like, you know, like you say, it's just, they're a giant variety act. There's just four leads all holding it together, you know, Joe, Don, Glenn, you know, Tim. And it just was interesting how, like you say, just all that progression was just essentially paid off. It just, and I was never surprised to know that they were often, it just on various music docs I would read, especially on the recent CNN one on Linda Ronstadt. And I was like, yeah, I always heard them recording in some of the same studio spaces as her and Jackson Browne. And obviously, you know, Walsh already had tons of experience with the James Gang. And, you know, you listen to it now and it's like, those are pretty much nowadays to me, they just always just sound like those are his warm-up sessions, you know, for what's about to come out later.
Yeah, Walsh is an interesting case. Obviously, when we're talking about the middle stretch of his career, we need to look at it through the context of his substance abuse problems and how his creativity was derailed by his addiction. But if we're talking about the front end of his career, it really is an interesting evolution. So in his pre-Eagles years, the first James Gang album is this big, sloppy, sprawling slab. It basically sounds like an American power trio trying to sound like Cream and really not terribly concerned with melody. It's just jams. But over the course of several albums, by the time he's doing his Barnstorm records and then his first proper solo album, which I think is So What, you can see him moving into a much more melodic space, where even though he'll have tunes that have thunderous guitar parts and pretty heavy riffs, there will also be quite gentle numbers that have synth washes or orchestral pieces. So in a way, he was finding himself toward a sound that was really compatible with the Eagles. So it's not at all surprising that they eventually converged. And as is well known within the lore of the band, they were trading favors musically. They were, the Eagles were appearing on Joe Walsh studio albums and live albums and showing up at his shows. He was showing up at their shows. They shared a producer by that point, Bill Simchick. So by the moment that Walsh enters the Eagles fold to replace founding member Bernie Ledden when he leaves, it's interesting to see him slot in. Because if you look at the songs that Walsh has actually brought to Eagles records, they're not on par with his most substantive solo work. And what I mean by that is this. So on Hotel California, he contributes that really beautiful original Pretty Maids All in a Row. It's very dreamy. It's very much of a piece with what he was doing on his solo stuff, but it's not a radio single the way that Life's Been Good or Walk Away is. Long Run, he contributes In the City, but that's a re-recording of a tune he had done for a soundtrack. And then the next two studio cuts he contributes to the band aren't until Long Road Out of Eden. And on Long Road Out of Eden, one of the two tracks is actually a re-record of a tune he had done for a TV soundtrack a couple years ago. So he really only contributes one proper original. And therefore, when you look at the entirety of Joe Walsh's contributions, he's only contributed two original songs to the band.
Damn.
It's funny because we think of him as having such a huge footprint in the band, and that's because I think what he contributed, and Fry talks about this in the History of the Eagles documentary, and I don't think anyone would refute this. The Eagles really wouldn't be the live show that they are without Walsh, and they wouldn't have survived as a live, as a touring entity without Walsh. Because if you look at clips of the OG Eagles, the original foursome, they just kind of stand there and play, and they're quite precise and they're skilled. But there's that very famous quote in which a Rolling Stone review described their stage presence as loitering, and Glenn took a lot of umbrage to that. But at the same time, he took the criticism to heart, which is, yeah, we're just not that interesting to look at live. I don't jump around like Robert Plant. I'm not cute like Paul McCartney. So there's nothing particularly visual about our act. But then when they bring in Joe, in addition to those just explosive guitar things that he can do, he brings in his Clown Prince personality. So he's goofy and he's big and he's playing with the audience. And even when you see the Eagles now, I last saw them in 2014, so quite a few years ago at this point, was the last tour with Glenn. But even when you see them now, there's just a huge energy uplift whenever Joe takes the focus, whether it's soloing or singing, because he's just got a lighthearted persona. Even though he's an incredibly serious musician, he manages to make what he does seem effortless. Whereas when you're watching Henley, it's a whole different experience. It's very impressive to watch him because he's so meticulous as a singer, and just mm-hmm. craft every tiny nuance of a note or a flourish. It's quite impressive, but it's the adjective, the description that stays in mind that I always liked was from a USA Today review of the first show of the reunion tour in 94. They described Henley as being grimly focused, and that's more or less my experience of seeing him live many times solo. I've seen him a bit looser on later tours, but he is very all business in a live show about trying to be as precise and meticulous in his performance, as opposed to Joe, who's never sloppy per se, but he just has a looser personality. And that was, I think that starts to provide some insights as to why he was such an interesting X factor to add to the band, even though when you look at the math, he actually didn't contribute that much material, because of course his most substantive musical contribution to the band was bringing in the riff that became Life in the Fast Lane. But Life in the Fast Lane is basically a Henley Fry composition built on a Walsh riff.
Wow. Well, so I'm backtracking a little bit. It is cool how you did kind of illustrate, you know, who deserves more of the credit, and how, again, the personas are so different. So again, that foreshadows, you know, the inevitable breakup and want to do solo careers. But do you kind of think it is sort of like a common, like Pete Townsend, Roger Daltrey kind of thing, like with the Who, like who's the real star? Or is it just...
Well, we see this evolution in every band. So again, to make the parallel to the Get Back documentary, and I always hesitate to call the Eagles the American Beatles. I know a lot of serious music fans who take affront at that, simply because those fans place the Beatles on an almost spiritual plane because of how important they were to the story of the 1960s, and I can see that. At the same time, however, I think they're one of the reasons that the Eagles did embed themselves into the popular consciousness as strongly as they did, is they were very acute chroniclers of their own moment. So earlier you said they talked about their upbringing, and I think you see touches of their upbringing in their work, probably more their solo work. However, from the beginning, from that first album, it feels like they're writing songs about the moment that they are in. So on that first album, it's "We're Young Musicians and We're Strivers and We're Young Guys on the Make Looking for Girls." So there's a reason that people connect with Take It Easy, because that is the attitude of a rake. That is a 20-year-old dude who's trying to string along a bunch of relationships and avoid the consequences. And you see, in essence, the character from that song evolve throughout the body of work that comprises the 70s albums. So you could almost say that the character in Take It Easy, which is a Jackson Browne composition that Glenn completed, you can almost say that that character is the same character who's trying to settle into a long-term adult relationship on the long run, which is the title of the last album. So to your question of where the power structure comes from in the band, the phrase that Don and Glenn particularly often used, and I'm sure they talk about this in the documentary, is this phrase, song power. And what they meant is, out of the gate, it was four equal partners. It's Don, Glenn, Randy, and Bernie. And the vocals are distributed pretty equally across the first two albums. But by the time the third album comes around, it becomes clear that Don has the most commercial voice by far.
So yes.
And it also becomes clear that Glenn has a really good ear for radio-friendly rave-ups, whether he wrote them or just sang them. So combined with the fact of Don and Glenn emerging as a songwriting entity on the second album, very famously, as they say in the documentary, they wrote Tequila Sunrise and Desperado in the first week as a songwriting duo, which is a pretty good.
Oh my God. Would you call that a rarity, kind of?
That doesn't happen too often.
Usually the song everyone is sick of playing, you know, that the producer suggests is the radio hit, and those are the ones that first coughed out.
Right. So they didn't get stuck with an albatross their first time out of the gate. And it's fascinating that because we think of the Eagles as a delivery device for Henley Fry songs, and there are no Henley Fry songs on the first album because they haven't started writing together. But in any event, once they started notching hits, Henley and Fry were pretty cognizant of the math. It's like, oh, Don Henley, I either co-wrote or sing almost every song of ours that's successful, and most of the other songs of ours that are successful that I don't solely write or sing are Glenn's material. So it's very clear that the marketplace is gravitating toward Henley stuff and Fry stuff to the detriment of Meisner stuff and Ledden stuff. So Ledden never scores a radio hit with the band. In fact, never scores a radio hit in his career. And Meisner doesn't score a radio hit until the fourth album, rather, with Take It to the Limit, which is a monster. It's an amazing song, and it's a pretty iconic piece of the songbook. But even that tune is co-written by Henley and Fry, because as Meisner has noted, he was a slow songwriter, and he would bring a sketch into the band, and usually Don and Glenn would come in and finish it. So by the time you reach One of These Nights in Hotel California, which collectively form the creative apex of the band, it's very clear who has stature. And that's when you reach a test of character with any band. How do people wield their power? And when we watch that Get Back documentary, we see that a lot of the friction comes from McCartney exercising his power. Because not only did he and or John create most of the hits in the band's history up to that point, Paul is clearly the one who came into the Get Back sessions prepared with a lot of material and a lot of ideas, and everybody else kind of lagging behind. So all the alienation that we hear about in the Eagles mythos of Bernie wanting to bail on the band, or Meisner getting sick of all the infighting, and then all the friction that eventually leads to Felder's termination and his lawsuit, a lot of that comes from Henley and Fry saying, yeah, we are the core of this band. Like it or lump it.
And see, this is kind of much like how there's just still commonly just so many issues that happen in society due to systematic imperfections that just will never be corrected anytime soon. You know, it's like, this is kind of another product. It's like all these bands would get together and not figure out all the paperwork right away of who gets residuals for what. And it, you know, it didn't help that, you know, they're coming on the cusp of, you know, when studios were being secretive about that whole thing, and then they find out years later what they were denied and then go to court.
Well, that's the funny thing, is that actually was not the trajectory of the Eagles, and that's unusual. And the friction that emerged relative to the early albums was really much more between Don and Glenn and David Geffen. So David Geffen, of course, was the founder of Asylum Records, which carried all of the original Eagles albums. Basically, throughout the 80s and 90s, even though Don goes to Geffen, which is Geffen's post-Asylum label, and releases his first three records on Geffen, they have a really bad falling out at the end of the 90s, and a lot of it has to do with publishing and music rights. You would think that given Don's litigiousness and given the prickliness of his relationship with his bandmates, you would think that the story would be that Bernie, in order, Bernie and then Meisner falling away from the 70s incarnation of the band would have fallen away because of exactly what you're talking about, squabbling about rights. But you know, by all accounts, in every interview he's given, Bernie, it was just, no, this isn't fun anymore. This went from being a fun musical ensemble with a bunch of equals to this is a J-O-B with two bosses who are kind of dicks. So he bails. He bails. Meisner, yeah. Very famously, there was a set to between him and Fry because when they were touring behind Hotel California, on which Meisner appears and behind which Meisner tours, Meisner, who was prone to a little bit of stage fright, even though he had been a veteran musician.
That's interesting because we're already talking about how Walsh is awkward on stage and Henley's charismatic and Fry, you know.
So Meisner, when they're touring behind Hotel California, the footnote to this is that recall that earlier in Meisner's career, he has a period between when he works for Rick Nelson in the early 70s and when he comes back to California and eventually joins the Eagles. There's a period where he just quits the business for about a year. So he had been fired from Poco. So he had had some bumps and bruises. He leaves the business for a year and just says, I don't know if I can hack this. Cut to 7 or 8 later is when he's touring behind Hotel California. So he's in the biggest band in the world. He's drinking heavily. There's a lot of friction in the band. And one point of friction is that Glenn would say on every show, we should do Take It to the Limit because you, Meisner, sing that really amazing high note at the end of the song and the audience just goes nuts for it. And Meisner in interviews has said, yeah, it kind of made me nervous because it's such a tough note to sing. And every time I would get up to sing it, I was thinking I was going to screw it up. And Glenn, who did not suffer weakness at all, would give him all sorts of guff about that, of just man up and do it. And that tension contributed to Meisner just saying, like Ledin had before, this just isn't fun, I want to leave. So they really don't have legal friction. It's much more interpersonal friction until the reunion. So the brief genesis of the reunion, and any fan of the band knows these milestones, so I'm not telling you anything you don't know. The brief genesis of the reunion is that as early as 1990, Irving Azoff, the band's longtime manager, is trying to get the group back together, even though Don is doing incredibly well in his solo career. Don has said words to the effect of, after his End of the Innocence album, which was a huge hit, sold 6 million copies, after that he felt like he had proved his point. Yeah, everyone kind of knows I'm the lyricist, I'm the literary guy in the band, and I'm the best singer. So I have claimed my territory in the band. Glenn has had some success in the 80s, but nothing on the order of what Henley did. So by the time he finishes his third solo album, he's like, yeah, I could get down with reacquainting with my Eagles legacy and maybe being an Eagle occasionally. So in 1990, a year after End of the Innocence comes out, the band reunites under Irving's urging to record a couple of new songs for a greatest hits package, because that was the vogue at that time, is you would put out a greatest hits package with one or two new songs to get attention. And that in the Eagles documentary, there's that famous scene where the other members of the band are all sitting around a studio in the valley in California waiting, and they get a fax from Glenn saying, yeah, just don't feel like showing up. So when they finally do get their act together quite literally in 94, at this point, the band members have started working together. So in 1990, at that period when they almost reunite, they actually do a show together. So Don does the Walden Woods benefit in Massachusetts, and he brings out Timothy and Glenn. So they do a whole Eagles set and people go nuts, but nothing comes of it. In the interim between that and Hell Freezes Over, Joe and Don do a duo tour. I remember going to see a Don show in 1990 and Schmidt showed up. So they were in and out of each other's lives and the ice was starting to thaw. But they also noticed that the album sales for the Eagles just did not diminish, and they knew that the demand was there. So it is pretty mercenary when they decide to get together, such to the point that, as we see in the documentary, they tell Joe unconditionally, it's like, if if you're going to be part of this and we want you to be part of this, you got to go to rehab and clean up, because we're not going to run this as a sloppy 70s tour where everyone's getting hammered and trashing their rooms. This is going to be a corporate enterprise at which we all make a whole lot of money. They then, meaning Don and Glenn, lay out pretty heavy contractual terms to their bandmates and say, yeah, us, Don and Glenn, the founders of the band and the two people who had the most successful solo careers in the years the band was dark, we're going to make more money than you other guys. So it's not camaraderie. It's not a democracy. And that kind of set a ticking time bomb with Felder, because Felder, even though he's a late arrival as he's billed on the border, even though he was only on the last three albums plus the live album, he feels like, well, you know, I was there. I wrote the music track from Hotel California. I should be an equal member. And Don and Glenn's attitude is, yeah, no, it's us. And then you guys are at a subordinate position. So that version of the band only holds together for 5 years, from 1999 till 1999, when after their Millennium concert, they fire Felder because they're just, Don and Glenn are just tired of his constant bitching about the inequity of the contracts. And then Felder sues them because he says, this was an unjustified termination. It wasn't for cause. It's not like I never showed up for a concert. It's not like I ever played a wrong note. You just don't like me anymore. So things get a lot nastier.
Oh dear.
In the second era of the band.
Do you think, other than these occasional documentaries, just no one really likes to talk about that? They just like to focus on the positive side of this, like with any breakup?
I give them a lot of credit for doing, if not quite a warts and all documentary, pretty close to a warts and all documentary. So there's some edgy stuff in the History of the Eagles documentary. You see the scene where Felder is talking about how pained he feels about having lost his relationships with everyone in the band, and he actually just takes his mic off and walks off. You see Glenn owning up to, oh yeah, there was our last show in the first run of the band in summer of 1980 in Long Beach. I was planning at the end of the show to beat the crap out of Felder. And I kept telling him, you know, it's one song left and then I'm gonna go kick your ass. And then Felder takes off. So they're pretty open about how ugly it got. And it's very clear when you see subsequent interviews with them that they made a very deliberate effort to sequester themselves from each other. So from 94 forward, when they tour, whether it's the 5-man lineup or the 4-man lineup, depending on which version it is, each person has their own trailer. And they basically don't see each other anywhere except for sound check, performance, and press appearances. They
just stay out of politics, baby. Nah, I don't want to be in the room unless we got to. You know, we got to be.
And it worked out well for them because obviously the reunion, which began in 1984, is creeping up on 20 years in various incarnations. I don't know how many tours they have left. The one they're on currently might be the last one. But they got 20 years out of being a heritage band, and during those 20 years, they've been consistently one of the most successful music draws in the world. So you can't fault the business model. As a fan, it would have been nice to see a version of the reunion where it was more clearly harmonious.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly when you listen to Long Road Out of Eden, which I don't think anyone would say is their best work, it's nice to have it. It's nice that they did another album, but it doesn't come close to the top rank of their discography. And for me personally, what I find most disappointing about that album is the way it's sequestered, to use that same term that I used in reference to the way they tour, where it almost seems like Don and Glenn arranged through lawyers to meet in a room and crank out a couple of songs together so that they could have the Henley Fry brand on the album. But then there are a whole bunch of tracks that sound exactly like every Don Henley solo album, and a whole bunch of tracks that sound exactly like every Glenn Fry solo album. So it's very clear that the whole enterprise was not a unified band effort. And you could say that's true of a latter-day Fleetwood Mac album. You could say that's true of a latter-day album by a lot of bands, where artists are kind of stuck with each other because that's where they achieve their greatest fame. But it is kind of a bummer to listen to a musical entity and have the sense that the people making the music together aren't really grooving on each other, but they're coalescing for business reasons.
Yeah, well, but that's evolution, though. I mean, And to get that big a change in pace, you know, you got to commend him for that, at least by wanting to just say, you know what, hey, you know, we did this tour, we did this reunion, you know, again, we're at each other's throats, but at least we're learning how invaluable we are as standalone artists and how everyone still just, you know, loves our brand. They love the artists that are these four.
My impression is Henley in particular, probably took him a while to get there, of appreciating what the band means to people. And I suspect, and I could be wrong about this, I suspect that the massive success of the Hell Freezes Over tour caught them a little bit by surprise, meaning they knew it was going to be a success. They were the first rock act in America to charge more than $100 for a premium ticket. The only artist who had done that in the American touring space that I'm aware of before them was Barbra Streisand. So they knew that they were a premium act and they were going to get their money for it. But my impression is it didn't really settle in for the band until after the tour and they realized, oh, we've done this first tour. We can now do 5 more legs and go see the rest of the world and then come back 5 years later and do another tour. I think when they realized, and this is just my impression, I could be wrong, I think when they realized how bottomless the well was of goodwill toward the band and interest in the band's music, that's when I think it started to hit them what an important legacy they had, where we aren't just a band that's going to reunite once and everyone's going to say, oh, it was cool if they got back together one time and now everyone's going to retreat back and make their solo albums. And we have all seen acts like that where they pop back together for one tour and everybody gets their fill and they don't.
And then they're gone.
There really aren't that many acts. And the Eagles are pretty close to unique with the possible exception of Fleetwood Mac. There really aren't that many acts that have reunited after a long hiatus and have been more successful as a touring entity post-reunion than they were in their heyday. Now, a lot of that has to do with changes in the way that tour business is constructed, but the Eagles were together for 8 years, basically. They formed in 70, well, call it 9 years. So they were formed in 71 and they broke up in 80. And yet they've now been together again for almost 20 years. That's, when you look at the math that way, that's kind of spectacular considering that 20 years into this reunion, they're still filling out, they're still selling out 20, 30, 50, 40,000 seat houses. That's kind of astonishing.
I would definitely say so. I mean, I know many who will just blindly go, even if they phased out of the Eagles. It's kind of like they are the go-to American band. Like, they represent the entire country somehow. And
I mean, I think you would be hard-pressed to name another American band of the Eagles vintage that can put over a viable live show that sounds in many ways as strong as it did back in the day. Now, in some ways, they actually sound better than they did back then in terms of musicianship and technical presentation, because, of course, music amplification back in the 70s was actually not that good. You wouldn't get very good sonic reproduction in an arena.
The stuff that's second nature now, you know, was not a thing.
Right, because I mean, everything can sound pristine and perfect. And of course, when the Eagles come out, it's not just the 4 or 5 of them. It's the 4 or 5 of them plus half a dozen support musicians. And that's not to take away from them. I mean, if you've been doing this for 20 years, you know, if you're Don and you're pushing, you're in your early 70s, yeah, sitting there singing and drumming a 3-hour show doesn't sound like a whole lot of fun. So having Scott Corrigo to take over the kit on half the set sounds like a pretty good idea. But I think you'd be hard pressed to name another American band of the same vintage that A, has any original members left, and B, is performing at that level of technical skill and at that level of popularity. I mean, the only analog I can think of, and I may be forgetting somebody really obvious, but the only analog I can think of is Fleetwood Mac, which parallels the Eagles in a lot of ways in terms of having their heyday at roughly the same period, producing a couple of breakout solo stars in the same way, getting together roughly the same period, and also having a similar amount of domestic drama among the membership.
That's a good contrast. I definitely always felt similar parallels with their similar production, how they kind of had a lot of folk lyrics in a 70s rock band format. And I saw how they often shared a lot of the same studios as Steve Winwood and the Doobie Brothers, who I think are very similar bands also. And Doobie Brothers, I mean, you had it where, I mean, my father was a hardcore fan during college, and kind of like Van Halen, you would often fall into the, you know, are you a fan of the pre-McDonald years or the post-McDonald years? And everyone would vary on that. And I think, yeah, with the Eagles, you know, it was pretty much all.
Yeah, with the Eagles, there are a lot of hardcore OG fans who, as soon as Bernie Ledden left after the fourth album and they moved into more of a rock direction, there are a lot of people who said, I just checked out after one of these nights because I liked them as a country rock band. And there are a lot of fans who aren't interested in seeing them post 2016 because they felt that Glenn was the core of the band, which he absolutely was. He was unquestionably the founder and he was the driver for a lot of the band's ambition. Henley became the focus because he's the solo star and because he has the most commercial voice, but it really is Glenn's band. And that's why after Glenn's death, when they were considering whether to keep the entity going, the reason they ultimately decided they were okay with it, even though of course the decision was at least partially driven by money, but one reason they decided they could make it viable is Glenn's son Deacon had performed at a big private tribute concert.
Oh, wow.
The band and the family all did for Glenn. He just came out and sang a couple of Glenn songs, and the Eagles collectively said, huh, he sounds pretty good. He looks pretty good. You know, this might work. But even when they went on the road with Deacon for the first time, they didn't give him Glenn's whole songbook. They brought in Vince Gill, who is a really wonderful veteran country singer-songwriter. And they said, let's split Glenn's songbook. So some of the more ambitious stuff, like Lion Eyes, New Kid in Town, let's send that over to the veteran who knows how to sell a 6-minute story song. And let's let Deacon take some of the easier stuff like Peaceful, Easy Feeling and Already Gone. And there's a bit of spiritual continuity where at least it's a member of the, it's not like they just replaced Glenn with an outsider, Vince Gill. They brought in Vince Gill to help carry the load so that Glenn's very inexperienced son could learn the ropes and come up. So it makes a nice story.
Do you think he's going to go far from what he's demonstrated so far, like even do his own solo thing?
I would assume so. I mean, he's actually off the tour right now. I don't know what the circumstances are, and I certainly don't want to.
I've heard a few ads post-COVID for him, but I don't know where they're performing. I think they did a Dallas, Texas tour. They might be doing a Louisiana.
This current leg of the tour, they're just performing it as a foursome because Deacon is ill. I don't think it's anything. I don't have any reason to believe it's anything serious, but he's just out of the tour temporarily. So they're performing it as a foursome. So it's Henley, Walsh, Schmidt, and Gill. So Gill's picked up a couple more numbers, and actually Schmidt is singing a couple more numbers, which is actually kind of a nice thing for him because for the better part of these 20 years, Schmidt has had two songs to sing at every Eagles concert, literally just two. Just every concert he sings, I Can't Tell You Why, and I'm blanking on his elevator music song because I dislike it so much, the one from Hell Freezes Over, Love Will Keep Us Alive. So for 20 years, he's just been doing those two numbers over and over again. Now, he has solo stuff on the side, but finally on this leg of the tour, through circumstances I'm sure he would not want to have happen, I'm sure he'd want to have Deacon there. But I know he's doing Peaceful, Easy Feeling, and he probably picked up a couple of other numbers. So this particular moment is actually kind of an interesting time to see the band because their set list is so regimented and has been for so long. This is the first time that circumstances have thrown them a loop and forced them to change up their set list and their distribution of singers. The first time they've had to make that kind of a change on the go in quite a while.
Interesting. Well, I think all together this has been good at just, you've done a masterful job of just summing up their essence, how they retained it, how the world is evolving in front of them, and they just don't realize just how they're just too cool for school. They're too they're too evolved to even realize that they're evolving. they're just too close to the material. They're
right. That's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it, and I think both perspectives are totally viable. Another way to look at it, and this tends to be my way into the band, is actually the opposite. The notion that they have positioned themselves as cultural observers. So if you think about some of the most iconic songs, like Life in the Fast Lane, like Hotel California, or even something later like Get Over It, which I like very much from the Hell Freezes Over album, it is from the stance of someone standing to the side of culture and commenting on culture. And you can see that same stance replicated in Henley's solo material, because a criticism that is often made of Henley, and it's a fair criticism, is that he's this sort of supercilious old crank who is judging everyone. But that's kind of the stance of the Eagles. But when the Eagles are firing, so take a song on the order of Lion Eyes, which I think is pretty unquestionably one of their masterpieces, that I think combines their outsider stance, we're describing society, with their unique gifts of harmony and melody and lyricism and guitar work, and fuses it into this 6-minute song that feels like a novella about the cycle of romance and betrayal and heartbreak. And that's, I think, when they're doing something that is uniquely theirs. They're combining storytelling and musicianship and attitude in a way that really does fuse the different elements of their musical DNA. So Lion Eyes has basically a country beat, but there's a rock guitar over it. And then there's a little bit of soul to the vocal. And then there's a little bit of doo-wop and Everly Brothers to the harmonies. So it's all of these different American influences coming together in a way that feels completely unified and coherent. And every band aspires to that. Every band aspires to find their identity. And if you think about the iconic songs for every band, they're unique. So to use just one example, Bohemian Rhapsody is the freakiest song you could possibly imagine ever being a pop hit. Mm-hmm. But it's because it is a perfect synthesis of Freddie's out there operatic sensibility and Brian May's incredible pop hooks and that great rhythm section. Stairway to Heaven, again, if someone explained that to you on paper, okay, if this gentle, medieval, lyrical thing for half the tune, and then it's basically Black Sabbath for the rest of it, on paper that doesn't make any sense, but it's such a perfect synthesis of Page and Plant and their collaborators. And I think that's true for the best moments of the Eagles. So Lion Eyes, Hotel California, on paper, something like Lion Eyes could sound like a generic Johnny Cash or Merle Haggard song, but that generic Johnny Cash or Merle Haggard song would be 2.5 minutes long. It wouldn't be 6 minutes. It mm-hmm. wouldn't have that literary quality that Henley brings to his material. And that literary quality combined with Fry's attitude and snarkiness, the way those two qualities spark against each other, I think that's where you get that unique thing that is very much this band that has lodged in people's imagination. And then when you combine that with all the other characteristics the band has. So at their apex, it's that Henley Fry storytelling ability, but then parallel to that, there are things like Best of My Love, where it's a very gentle love song, happens to be a good literate song, but it's gentle and adult contemporary in its contours. And on the other hand, you have Life in the Fast Lane or Get Over It, which is pretty hard-driving rock.
Everything is them venting, offering insights into how they feel, I guess you could say, unwelcome in this world at times, and striving through, pursuing the American dream, having a rough and tough kind of life. But yes, I mean, I don't know how any of these were able to become radio hits. They're just such dark material, even in the titles itself. So it's like, it's not like you didn't have a fair warning of what they're singing about, you know?
Right, and I mean, one of my favorite quotes from the band's life cycle is, Glenn once said, "Without Don, we're Air Supply." And what he meant by that is, if you just let me, Glenn, go at it, I'll just write pretty love songs all day long. And so there's a reason that he has hits with things like The One You Love and Soul Searching. They're gentle, undemanding, very pretty love songs, but they're almost simplistic by comparison to some of Henley's more literary stuff. And yet, Henley, left to his devices, can be really cynical to the point of being off-putting. So he's been very smart to surround himself with collaborators. So there's a reason that End of the Innocence resonates the way it does. If you just read the lyric on paper, it's a pretty hostile lyric. It's a treatise on some basic flaws in the DNA of the American character, but it's set to that really involving, magical Bruce Hornsby melody. So Henley's very smart about, if I want to put these tough messages out there, I need to coat them in a bit of sugar. And where Glenn was quite knowing is, he said, yeah, left to my own devices, I'll just provide the sugar. But if the sugar isn't around a pill that's worth swallowing, then we're not that substantial a band. And I think that's probably the easiest way I could describe what I find so fascinating about that musical partnership, is Henley's giving you that bitter pill that is good for you. It makes you think, it challenges you, and maybe his attitude will piss you off, but there's no question there's a lot of thought behind it. And Fry is there to put a little melodic sugar around it, so you almost don't realize you're getting that socio-political messaging because it's coming in the form of a really radio-friendly pop song.
Very well said. I don't think a partnership like this could even happen today now. There's just so many different kind of personas echoing different kinds of tastes. And would you say these guys were from similar walks of life, but yet just so dissimilar after a while, to where it's like they...
Again, they were from... Don and Glenn were from completely opposite walks of life, because Glenn is a tough street kid from Detroit, and Don is this bookish literature major from small town Texas. So they came from completely different worlds, but they were both drawn to the bright lights of Hollywood. And interestingly, in their, the way they converge is that their first two albums with bands preceding the Eagles are both issued on the same label. So at that time, this is 69-70, the Troubadour on Santa Monica Boulevard in West Hollywood is the nexus for the music scene. So that's famously where Elton John had his breakout performance. Carole King, James Taylor, a lot of these artists put themselves on the map by performing at that venue. So Glenn gets to town first, and pretty quickly upon arriving in LA, he meets J.D. Souther, who ironically is born in Detroit, but raised in Texas. So he's sort of like the gene splice of Don and Glenn. Glenn and J.D. form a duo that only lasts one album called Long Branch Penny Whistle. Around the same time, Don is with a band called Shiloh, which is an evolved version of his high school college band. They get a deal through, of all people, Kenny Rogers, who was at that point famous as the singer of a band called The First Edition. So Kenny Rogers agrees to produce an album for Don's group, Shiloh. They come to LA to record it. So at the, roughly the same time, Don releases this failed album with Shiloh, and Glenn releases this failed album with Long Branch Penny Whistle. They converge at the Troubadour Nightclub. And
what year was this?
They would have met probably 70, 71. Probably 70. And then the final clicker is that at that moment, when these guys have met each other and started to bond, John Boylan, who is Linda Ronstadt's producer, starts trying to put together a retinue of musicians who will be a rotating cast of players for her albums and her tours. So in different hires, John Boylan hires Don to play drums and sing harmonies, Glenn to play guitar and sing harmonies, Bernie Ledden to play guitar and sing harmonies, and Randy Meisner to play bass and sing harmonies. Very famously, the four of them only play one gig together with Linda Ronstadt at Disneyland. But once they are together as a unit, they very quickly realize, oh, this, there's something here. We want to try this. Because Glenn was originally intending to be a solo artist, but he was advised by David Geffen, you would be much better as the front man of a band. And he took that advice to heart. Don, for all of the confidence that we associate with him later, was really shaky on his feet as a songwriter at the beginning. He didn't have a lot of confidence. So when he was approached about being in a band, that was what he knew and that's what made sense. And it really was Glenn's idea for a band. So those two form the nucleus. Then they bring in Bernie and Randy and they're off and running.
Man, that's a mouthful. But it does make sense because, yeah, they were, had some of the same producers as Ronstadt and were using her studio originally. So, but man, no, how do you get this all configured? How do you get this all memorized in your mind?
Well, like I said, this is why I ended up doing the blog. It's just,
They connect with you.
I enjoy cataloging the things that I enjoy. And I, because I've been listening to this band for quite a few decades at this point, I've had plenty of time to consider all the connections. And one thing that was really enjoyable about putting the blog together was to write the initial post, which was just a very brief biography. There's nothing in there that would be new to a serious fan because it's basically the same milestones that are described in, to some degree, the History of the Eagles documentary. But for me, it was an interesting exercise to consolidate that down into about 1,000 words. How succinctly can I tell the story of the formation of the band, the run of the band, the breakup, the reunion, and where they are now? And what I found is by synthesizing that down to a short piece that is in the neighborhood of 1,000 or a couple thousand words, it allowed me to see all these connections much more clearly, because then it's like taking the story, looking at it under a microscope. Oh, this event led to this event led to this event.
It all adds up eventually. Well, thank you ever so much for mapping out this timeline and the cultural influence just being consistent and being perfectly summed up for today's audience. So other than every Eagles song blogspot, what else do you have coming out besides your books?
Oh, I'm mostly working on other projects right now. So I'm in my real life, I'm a film teacher and I'm involved in screenwriting. So I have a couple of projects that are bubbling there. Nothing that is ready to be announced. So for now, I'm perfectly happy to hype this blog because it was fun to write, and I hope it'll be fun for people to read. So the content of the blog is, because the title is Every Eagles Song, several of the posts are just a ranking, and rankings are what they are. They're just subjective fun. It's just my ranking of the 88 or so songs that the band recorded, and obviously starting from 1 and going to 88 on diminishing levels of quality according to my taste. But within each review, hopefully is a little bit of behind the scenes information about the song, maybe a couple of interesting thoughts about interpretations or musical quality. And certainly for casual fans, one thing that I hope is useful is tracking who sings what, because since there have eventually been something like 6 or 7 lead singers in the band, it can be, unless you're a really close fan, it can be difficult to track the voices. And to that point, one thing that was really fun for me to do was to center Meisner, who I think is really underrated. But getting back to your question, that's probably the most enjoyable thing for people to take a look at right now, because it's new and fresh, and it's topical because this is the 50th anniversary year of the band, because the first album came out in 1972. So that was the occasion for the blog, and it's the occasion for having this chat today, and always happy to celebrate the band, because even though I wouldn't quite call myself a super fan, but I'm probably pretty close to a super fan, I can certainly see the flaws, I can see the things they haven't done well, and I can see the kinks in their personalities, but what remains at the end of the day is my great gratitude and respect for their songbook.
Sweet, 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 sweet. Thank you ever so much for being on here.
My pleasure.
We'll return after these messages.
Hey, feeling down? Feeling low? Not enough podcasts about movies in your life? Why not try?
They must be destroyed on sight!
The new podcast cure-all, sure to get you right with the world and on a path to better living. We have exploitation, we have Italian horror, we have zombies, we have slashers, we have crime films, we have spaghetti westerns, we even have sci-fi and sex comedies. So take a dose of...
They must be destroyed on sight!
As needed, and let the hosts, Lee Russell, Daniel Harper, Paul Romali, and the odd guest host cure what ails you.
Warning, may cause atrophy, African consumption, black fever, bone shave, chin cough, colic, cramp colic, dropsy of the brain, elephantitis, grocer's itch, jaundice, mania, miasma, mortification, palsy, Pott's disease, rheumatism, scurvy, St. Anthony's fire, summer complaint, and worm fit in some people. Consult a physician before listening.
Did you ever see a film at such a young age it left you traumatized with cinematic wounds?
Necrophilia.
It's a dead issue, man. Don't push it. Cinema Psyops is a weekly podcast documenting an ongoing experiment on the mind of an unwilling test subject.
No one should have to watch this movie.
Oh, no one should have to watch this?
No one should have to watch this movie.
Surprisingly, it's not a topic that a lot of people really want to tackle.
I'm shocked, Prudes.
I know, really.
Right?
It's the next sexual frontier that no one wants to explore.
I am, in the most sincerest of senses, disappointed in you.
It takes a powerful goddess like Connie, jam her arm down the monster's throat and kill it. I'm still tripping out over that. Even as a kid, I was like, I gotta find a girl like that. Every week, I get a new look of disappointment that I never thought I could get out of.
It's unimaginable. At 12 years old, you should not be watching this movie.
Obviously.
At 13, you should not be. 14, you shouldn't be. I'm not entirely sure even 17-year-olds should be watching this movie.
Just because you're offended by something doesn't mean that you have the right to demand that it doesn't exist. Watching this film again, I had all of this, like, little nerd glee with everything that kept
little history
up.
Doll yeah, popping up
absolutely.
At you.
So I totally loved this film.
Hey, I know why you couldn't see that. It's because your brain's warped watching this shit at 12 years old.
Yeah, this is a rough movie. I told you ahead of time when we were getting ready to do it that it was going to be a rough
movie.
How did
you watch this shit at 12?
Because physical wounds heal, cinematic ones don't. Listen to Cinema Psyops.
Hey, everybody. I'm Corey.
And I'm Zach. And we're the hosts of Podcasting After Dark, a cast dedicated to late-night horror and sci-fi of the 80s and 90s, often found on HBO and Cinemax.
You know, the movies your parents didn't want you watching as a kid. You can find us every other week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, and Stitcher.
This is what you want.
This is what you get.
It's time, let's check our cue, baby. Pair it with a couple brews, baby. We love good movies. We love the bad ones too. So we watch them all and pass their lessons on to you. Oh yeah.
Bana 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 out. Bana 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 out.
Everything I learned from movies helps to make life a little bit groovy. We're the one last plot holes of gratuitous movies. It's time to get busy with your friend Steven Izzy
at EILFM.podbean.com.
We now continue with our program.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening.
It's a jacked up.